Hi everyone, and thanks for coming. It's good to see you all on a Saturday afternoon. We called it Radio Summer, and it's not quite summer in San Francisco, but summer is to come, and so is radio. My name is Tracy Rosenberg. I'm the director of Media Alliance, which is a 35-year-old media activism and advocacy nonprofit in the Bay Area. We were in San Francisco for 25 years, so we consider ourselves an honorary San Francisco organization, but we joined many nonprofits in a diaspora to the East Bay a couple of years ago, and we've been in Oakland for the past 6 years. What we do is build public awareness about issues surrounding community and alternative independent media sources, and try to build a regional constituency for media justice and media reform. We're holding this panel today for two reasons. One of them is the tremendous opportunity that awaits all of us in a low-power FM window that is going to open one of these days. In my description for this panel, I called it a first and a historic and an only window, and I was told that there may be a couple of steps to that window, so not to call it the only, but it is a first, and it will be a history-making occasion. The other reason that we're holding this is that the National Federation of Community Broadcasters held a conference in San Francisco, just a couple of blocks away, at the slightly fancier Park 55 Wyndham Hotel. And we felt that it was really important to make it clear in the context of community broadcasters that those of us who will be coming on board as Low Power FM are a part of that family, and that their issues are our issues and vice versa. So a couple of things. My own experience with LPFM started in 2000 when I was working for the agency that I now direct. And the National Association of Broadcasters was coming to San Francisco. That is the trade group of what we call the mainstream media. So all the big broadcasters were coming to town, and they were coming to town on the heels of blocking the implementation of Low Power FM. They were joined in that unfortunate effort by National Public Radio, and something that might strike some of you as a bit of a flashback. Which was stating that these small 10 to 100 watt stations on what we call second and third adjacent channels would hypothetically interfere with some of their NPR services, primarily stations for the blind that were operating on some of those channels. Many, many years of engineering studies proved that to be bogus, but it took 10 years for that argument to be thoroughly disabused and for the legislation that we were fighting for in 2000 to come into being in 2010. So we have this tremendous opportunity in one big sort of, well, in one long, expansive proceeding, but in one chunk of time, we have this huge opportunity to probably build more media diversity in one big chunk than has happened at any point in history. We probably have the biggest opportunity to provide local news and information in one big chunk that has ever occurred. And the question here is whether the promise and the potential of this law and this legislation and this possibility will really truly come into being. And what that means, because we all know that there's this long and kind of winding road in between a piece of legislation that sounds good and then what actually happens down the line. So our defense to sort of traveling down that winding road is really all of you, and all of you having a commitment on some level or the other to making sure that what could happen really does happen. So whether you're here to explore the possibility of starting your own LPFM, whether you're here as a community organization just to get some information on what this is going to look like, if you're just here because you'd like to see these stations actually get on the air, either way, there's a huge role to play. So we have really a terrific panel, some of the foremost experts on community radio in the country. We're very lucky to have them. And again, we were holding this panel because we were lucky enough to have them fly into San Francisco, not at our expense, and we wanted to sort of share their expertise. with everybody here. And we also have a representative from a local group out in Alameda that is giving some thought to pursuing an LPFM station for that area, and hopefully that will provide an inspirational example to all of you. Before we get started with the panel, just some bookkeeping stuff. Much of what we're going to talk about is going to be referrals to resources that are online, kind of available. We would like to, and we promise that we won't pester you or take advantage of it, but we would like to get your email addresses, all of you, so we can continue to forward you information and also send some follow-up stuff about where to find some of the stuff that we're going to talk about. So I'm going to pass out a sign-up sheet and hopefully we'll take advantage of it. There's a pen that travels. And I'm going to thank our co-sponsoring organizations, which including my own are the Committee on Democratic Communications from the National Lawyers Guild, Common Frequency, the National Federation of Community Broadcasters, and Prometheus Radio Project. Okay, so with that, I'm going to hand the microphone over to Vanessa Maria Graber, who is the, the Community Radio Director at Prometheus Radio Project. Prometheus Radio Project has been the heart and the soul and the spirit of the LPFM movement for years, and now they are transitioning from being the most ferocious advocates in the world to being a conduit for the birth of hundreds of new stations. So, Vanessa?
Thank you. Hello, everyone. It's really great to be here. I'm really excited to tell you all about how to start a low power FM radio station. So just to give you a little bit of history again, in the 90s, there was this really big demand to have more community media. The FCC did not take that call to action by issuing licenses. So right here in the Bay Area, there was a big movement started to do pirate radio stations and start off with Radio Free Berkeley. Stephen Denifer is kind of a, pirate radio legend in the U.S. Inspired lots of other people all around the country to do pirate radio, including in Philadelphia, the home of Prometheus Radio Project, where he had Radio Mutiny start. And so the idea was to place pressure on the FCC to start issuing more licenses for low-power FM radio. Finally, in 2000, we were successful in getting the FCC to do that. They issued over 860 licenses. More than half of those, unfortunately, went to religious networks that piped in programming that was not local. After that, the big broadcasters were really upset. They claimed that these little LPFMs caused all types of interference with their big stations. So they lobbied Congress to pass the Radio Preservation Act, and that limited and restricted the amount of LPFM licenses that could be issued. And so the FCC has not been able to expand the program since. The Local Community Radio Act, which was passed in December of 2010 after a 10-year battle, mandates the FCC to expand the LPFM program in light of this new research that says that the interference isn't be a problem. In January, Obama signed that piece of legislation, made it law. So now we're anxiously awaiting the FCC to figure out how they're actually going to implement this expansion of LPFMs. So to that end, I'm going to try to explain to you the upcoming timeline that's ahead of you so you can sort of visualize in your mind what kind of time frame we're working in and what the next steps are. So in order for the FCC to be able to expand LPFM, they have to make rules about the program, how people are going to apply, what channels are going to become available, etc. So they have what is called a rulemaking. During this time, the public is invited to submit comments. So if you give us your information, we'll let you know when that happens, and you all can advocate for yourselves and your community about why you think community radio is important and what protections you think the FCC should issue and the type of application process you think will be most fair. Prometheus Radio is a really big advocate for LPFM, as Tracy mentioned. We will be updating all of our constituents, giving people advice and, you know, letting them know the kinds of things to advocate for if you're uninformed. So be sure to sign up on the sign-up sheet, encourage others to go to our website and fill out the form. We have a monthly e-newsletter, gives updates from interactions with the FCC. So you'll be sure to know when the rulemaking happens. After the rulemaking happens, we hope they will set a date for a filing window. A filing window is the period of time when the FCC accepts applications for LPFM licenses. We're not sure if they will do all of the application filings at one time or if they will have several windows done regionally. But of course, we'll keep you up to date as more information trickles down through the FCC. But we anticipate, based on our interaction with the FCC, that it will happen as early as next year, so summer of 2012. That said, the FCC has a lot of stuff to do and can be quite unpredictable, so it may be earlier, it may be later. Again, you know, it's kind of like the weather here in the Bay Area. I kind of have to pay attention hourly to see how it might change. After they have a filing window, that's the time when you submit your applications. They accept them for filing, which basically means they process them. You will get a letter back saying they've accepted your application. And then they'll parse out the applicants into two groups. First group being singleton. If you're a singleton, it means nobody else in your area has applied for the same frequency, and so you basically have no competition for the license. If you filled out your paperwork correctly and meet the criteria set forth by the FCC, you're more than likely to be issued a license rather quickly. If you are in the second group, which is called an MX group, you are competing with a bunch of others in your area for a frequency or a frequency that's nearby. This is the trickiest part of the application process. Depending on how many groups you're MX with, it can be anywhere from a year to 4 years to find out what your status is. Just to put that in perspective, in 2007, there was a licensing opportunity for full power stations, non-commercial educational stations, and it's 2011, and there's still groups waiting to see whether or not they'll get the license.
Hello.
4 years later, yes, Mr. Ellinger can attest to that. Being in an MX group can be quite draining on your soul. But if you're in it for the long haul, I guarantee you it's well worth the investment of time. So after you've been MX'd, you find out who your other competitors are. There's a settlement window. That's an opportunity you have to sort of collaborate and wheel and deal with your competitors. You can either knock them out by finding information on their application that takes them out of the running. You can approach them and try to pay them off to withdraw. You can collaborate with them and see if you can share time on the station. Or, you know, you can just politely ask them to withdraw because you don't like them or whatever. There's many variations of this. Or if none of those happen, then the FCC decides. They usually go to a point decision, and they will decide who has the best application. Now, another strategy that quite a few people have discussed is getting multiple groups to apply for the same frequency. That way, if you're MX'd, you can put your applications all together at the end. Now, the only way this works is that if you have the most points in your MX group, then you're able to add more people to your group and consolidate applications. So I can apply for a frequency under my nonprofit. Maybe Todd will apply too, and we'll ask Susan to apply. But then at the end, we'll actually pull all of our applications together because we're all shooting for the same, you know, frequency and station, and, you know, we're ultimately going to be working together. That's a strategy. It all depends on how they decide what the point system will be. In the past, they gave points to groups who were nonprofits that had been in existence for 2 years or more. And they give points to, you know, groups who serve a particular unique community or community that has not been served before, population-wise as well. So during the rulemaking, you can advocate for the kinds of points that you want to give folks. Some people have been saying that they don't think it's fair to give an extra point to nonprofits that have been in existence for 2 years or more, because lots of groups are forming new nonprofits just to be able to apply for the license. So we are happy to take everyone's feedback and input for that, and then, you know, advocate on your behalf accordingly. So that brings me to the requirements for applying. You have to be a nonprofit organization, but you don't have to be a 501c3. You just have to be registered through your state. You have to have a board of directors. They have to live within 30 miles of the transmitter site. So you can't collect a bunch of people from across the country. They actually have to be in and out of the community. And you have to have a, you know, educational mission, but the FCC doesn't really have any standards for what that is. So if you determine that playing, Eurotrance bluegrass mix all day long is your way to educate the community, the FCC is not going to argue with you on that. It's also free to apply. You don't have to pay money to apply for the license, which is great, but there are some costs involved with having a lawyer or an engineer look over your application. So after you have, you're either a singleton or MX, ultimately you get a construction permit from the FCC, and that's a sort of temporary license. It lasts for 3 years, and you have that time to build your station, get the equipment you need, do testing, and get on the air. If you're not on the air in 3 years, then the FCC can take away the license, and it sort of goes into a black hole. Some groups that aren't able to build the station within 3 years have the opportunity to transfer the construction permit to another nonprofit. We're seeing that happen a lot right now because of the economy and groups not being able to do fundraising, and also because federal funding, such as Corporation for Public Broadcasting monies and public telecommunications fund monies, have been cut out of the budget. So it's been increasingly difficult for them to raise money. But for LPFMs, the costs are a lot less than these full power stations facing that trouble. It costs anywhere from $10,000 to $50,000 to get your station up and running. And like I said, you have 3 years to do that. And then hopefully you will flip the switch and go on the air and be broadcasting. So unfortunately, we don't have any exact dates. This is kind of like a continuum, you know. If you're a singleton, you can get on the air maybe in 2 years from now, or 3 years from now. It depends on the access to studio space and equipment. If you're an MX, you have trouble fundraising, it can be anywhere from 5 to 6 years. So we hope you're all dedicated and patient and enthusiastic about this process. But that's basically all the steps in a nutshell. We have all of this information on our website, prometheusradio.org. There's an equipment guide, there's frequently asked questions, there's, you know, this whole breakdown. We have a policy section too, where you can receive information and updates from the FCC. So I encourage you all to read over that information. I gave you, you know, the 10-minute version, but there's lots and lots of information to read. So after this, I encourage you to go on the website and download some stuff and share a link with friends. So right now I'm gonna pass it off to Todd from Common Frequency. If you don't know Common Frequency, you really should. They're this really amazing nonprofit organization based out of Davis, California. And they have built lots and lots and lots of stations all over California and the Northwest. So Todd's really your go-to guy when it comes to engineering stuff and equipment. And he's going to tell you the most important part of this discussion, which is how to find an available frequency.
Hi, my name is Todd Urich. I'm from Common Frequency. It's a nonprofit just about an hour and a half outside of the Bay Area, hour or so, I don't know. Actually, about half of our board of directors is in the Bay Area now. So a couple of us are here. Jeff Shaw right over here helped found an LPFM station in Davis, very successfully operating right now in association with a public access TV studio nonprofit, Davis Media Access. It's KDRT-LP. And also Gavin Dahl in the back there. What is your official position? Community Broadcast Coordinator at Common Frequency. And we started about 4 or 5 years ago. How long ago, Jeff?
2006.
We formed because there's generally a lack of new community radio stations, and we all know of Pacifica and a few other community radio stations, and there's a smattering of LPFMs here and there that are community oriented, but we wanted to vastly increase that number. And since then, we helped several groups. We've helped groups all across the United States, but we've concentrated a lot on California and Oregon and Washington and the West Coast, applying for new full power stations. These are stations like full power, non-commercial, educational radio stations, which are anywhere from 100 to 100,000 watts. And we have several of these applicants that are getting permits across California. So we travel from place to place giving presentations and helping people with the technical details and legal things and the nuances of whatever you need to file. And it's very important that when you're filing for an FCC license that you take the appropriate steps, because you need to make sure that you file a, you know, usually you might want to consult a lawyer about this, but if you don't have enough money, that's what we form Common Frequency for. We'll give you the information, but be sure to ask questions if you don't know how to do something, because if you slip up in the application process, that might bite you back in 2 years down the road or a year down the road or whenever they start looking at the application and you have competitors. So I'm just going to go over a list here of commonly asked questions, and maybe I'll elaborate on a few of the things Vanessa has touched upon, but more from a technical point of view. Is it complicated to apply? Actually, it's not too complicated to apply, although there are some stumbling blocks somewhere, some places in the applications. In the application that you need to get right. The cost is absolutely free. All you have to do is log on to the FCC's website. They have a special site called abbreviated CDBS. You could just Google FCC CDBS, and they have a place where you can log in to create an account. And you want to create an account under a nonprofit, under your nonprofit's name, and you'll need your IRS EIN number in order to do that. So if you don't have one, get one in advance and anticipate that, because there are some nonprofit associations that aren't incorporated, and you also are invited to apply. You don't have to be, like Vanessa said, an IRS 501c3 to apply. And I believe you don't even need to be incorporated to apply, but you need some type of proof that you've been around and in the community. Now, once you have a CDVS account from the FCC, you can log in and check the applications. Actually, you can I believe you can download a PDF of the instructions for these FCC applications, and at times they are long and sometimes don't make sense, but be sure to ask questions. And you can fill out this application. By the way, the final LPFM application is not up on the FCC website yet, and they're going to be making some changes before that happens. But you'll be able to log in and fill out the application in advance. But in order to submit the application, usually it's in a short duration filing window, and that can be, we're thinking that it would be like maybe a week, 2 weeks, maybe they'll even open it up for longer than that. The last LPFM filing windows were regional, meaning that for each state they had different times to apply, but the FCC is right now thinking about one large window. So things might get hectic, and if you are thinking about applying, get the information in advance, because the professionals, if you go to them even a month before the filing window, are going to be, you know, panicking about getting all these applications in, because some people have to, if you're getting an engineer to file yours, the at engineer might have upwards of, you know, 20 to over 100 applications to file during that window. A second common question asked is, what does it cost to apply? What does it cost for the equipment for the LPFM? And when you're applying for an LPFM or any FCC license, it's important not to rush out and put your studio together right when you apply. You don't need any of the equipment available. It's sort of a speculative thing. You don't know if you're going to get the license yet, so don't invest in anything yet. And I won't go into the details of the equipment, but when you do apply, the FCC wants to know that you have funds sort of earmarked, or you know where to obtain some funds. Maybe you have dedicated funds somewhere to build this station, because they don't want you to obtain the construction permit and not build it and just let it sit there for 3 years, you know, when somebody else could use it, and just let it go without building it. So they'll probably ask you if you have the funds on hand to build the station, possibly in the application. The cheaper tier of LPFMs may start off at about, what would you say, Jeff Shaw, about $7,000 if you...
To start a LPFM?
Like pulling together the funds for if you have donated equipment in some areas.
I'd say $14,000.
Oh, $14,000.
Donated equipment, then $11,000.
Okay.
Yeah, we say anywhere from $10,000 to $50,000. It depends on if you get new equipment or old equipment, and if you have studio space that's donated, or you have to build a studio, whether or not you build a tower, have an existing tower, or rent on a tower, and the kind of antenna you buy.
So you'll probably be looking for, say, a 100-watt transmitter eventually, and the dirt cheapest 100-watt transmitter is probably around, you know, $3,000 and up or something like that. But there is used equipment out there. Also, the price is going to be dependent upon whether you put this your antenna and transmitter at the facility that you're broadcasting from, or you're going up onto, say, a mountain or a co-located tower site, in which you're going to need to spend money on what's called a studio to transmitter link, or you could even use the internet to get the site to the site. And that, you know, if you're using a licensed STL, it might be, you know, maybe you have some donated equipment, it could start off at, you know, $7,000 or so and up. But you can nowadays use the internet to get your signal to the transmitter site. Another question, do I need help in applying? Traditionally, with the LPFM applications, they made it simple that you can use the instructions available on the application to file it yourself. In this next round of applications, though, they are going to change the methodology, the technical methodology allowed for applying, so that we're able to use frequencies that haven't traditionally been able to be used as LPFM channels. And this is going to require the consultation of a broadcast engineer. And I emphasize that when you're looking for an engineer, there's all types of engineers out there, and you might know one that, you know, even one that is extreme, has a lot of knowledge in even radio, but you want one that actually has done applications before. Because if you slip up on this process, there's no going back. To get a broadcast engineer that's filled out an applications before, you're looking at around possibly, I don't know how much for an LPFM application in general, but the non-commercial applications that engineers have filed in the last few years, it starts at about, you know, $3,000 per application, and I think about $3,000 might do, unless you're contacting a established engineering firm that works with mainly commercial broadcasters, and that firm may charge more. Common Frequency and Prometheus Radio Projects, we do that type of work ourselves. We can do engineering studies. Common Frequency does it via donation. We have a sliding scale that we can charge, that we accept to do applications. We don't want to see anybody miss out on this opportunity because they have they don't have the money to do it. So we've done free applications, and
too many
actually. And that's I will go hungry if maybe you don't donate something. And our nonprofit doesn't have a lot of money either. So another question: how far will the signal go? Right now, there's two classes of LPFMs, and mainly the FCC has opened a window for what's called LP100 applications, and that's a 100-watt transmitter at, I believe, 30 meters above height above average terrain. So that means if you go up higher than 30 meters above the average terrain, that means you're going to slightly go down in wattage. There are LPFMs that are, I believe, 1 watt. There's a few of them, just because they get so high up on a mountain that they make the FCC makes you have a certain contour radius that and that's how they do it, a combination of height and wattage. If you go up higher, you're able to cover more, so the wattage goes down. Your coverage will depend upon what what other facilities are using that channel. When I refer to a facility, commercial radio stations will be using the same channels you to use. A license called a translator will use the same. Generally, it's, a 3-mile radius? How far does KDIRT go?
3.5.
If you have a station on your same channel, it could be curtailed. You could be getting interference in a certain direction when you go a certain way, and maybe there's another station in the other direction. There's also what's called an LP10, which is a 10-watt license, and they haven't really opened a filing opportunity for that, and I think they've even rethought about those licenses just because they only cover, you know, a few blocks. But LP10 sounds like a good solution for a neighborhood radio station. There is unlicensed broadcast. If you don't want to get obtain a LPFM, it's very dinky wattage stations, and you can talk to me about that if you want. I just helped a carrier current low power AM station in LA start a few weeks ago in Chinatown down there. Another question: are there radio channels going to be available? And this is a big question that we get all the time. And most likely, if you call me up, I'll give you a long-winded answer, and then say I don't know or something like that. If you're in a rural area, there will probably be many channels available. Right now, the FCC is sort of debating how to move forward with the amount of channels available for LPFMs. And just to give you some background, there are four or so different types, four or five different types of FM licenses. There's the commercial radio license, which is in the commercial band, that's above 92 FM, and these are your basic pop radio. Thanks. Pop radio stations up to 100,000 watts. There's non-commercial radio stations that are below 92 FM that are also up to 100,000 watts. There's boosters, which commercial and non-commercial stations utilize within their same vicinity of broadcast. They use them to fill in areas of blocked, that their signals block from terrain. There are translators, and the issue of a translator license is one of the debates right now, which is sort of blocking LPFM in the major urban areas. And a translator is it's basically a low power broadcast facility that basically rebroadcasts another full power radio station's signal, or actually low power stations could use them too. But and this is when you hear the hear about religious right neighbor networks. This is the tool that they use to beam their signal all across the United States. So basically, what happened in 2003 was the FCC opened up a filing window.
You're getting there though.
Okay, for groups to file translators, and people filed thousands of applications, and a lot of them were just speculative in nature. A lot of people wanted to make money off obtaining these licenses and reselling them. And basically, a lot of these groups applied for all the frequencies in the urban areas. And one group applied for about even a few thousand
at a time. And basically, after the filing window, the FCC started blindly granting all these translator applications, and some of the groups started selling them for profit. And the FCC frowned after a while and froze granting any of these translators, and that's where we are right now. And in a lot of urban areas, these translator applications are taking up frequencies, so we don't know if the FCC is going to cancel some of these applications to make way for more low-power radio, or they're going to grant these applications. And if they do grant all of them, like they wanted to grant a lot of them in the urban areas, there will be no frequencies left in urban areas, or very few, like maybe one or two, for LPFM. But just recently, in the last 6 months, Common Frequency did some studies on these translator applications, and we submitted them to the FCC, and we showed the FCC that there would be no channels left, or very few channels left in urban areas if they allow granting these applications. So the FCC has paused, and in the next few months they're going to release a new report, and we think that it's going to favor LPFMs in urban areas. So I'm thinking that there will be channels available to apply for in the San Francisco Bay Area, if that's where most of you are from. Now, Vanessa touched upon what is needed to apply, and that the FCC has a point system. Basically, you want to be an established local applicant. You want to be established, you have your nonprofit established 2 years prior to the filing window. And one of the things that I see groups stumbling upon when they file these applications is they don't affix enough documentation to their application proving that they've existed for 2 years. And a lot of the applicants that we're helping in community, well, not a lot of them, a certain percentage of them did not affix this proof to their application, and they lost out to the religious broadcasters, the megacasters. So consulting with Common Frequency or Prometheus about how to affix this documentation onto your application would be a very good thing. What happens after you apply? I know Vanessa went into this a little bit. You put your application in, the filing window closes. Within a few weeks, the FCC is going to release, publish the names of all the groups that have applied in the window. And in order for you to figure out if you're anxious to figure out who your competitors are within a few weeks of when the FCC publishes these things, you can hire an engineer or whatever engineer you had to file your application to check upon what is called these mutually exclusive filings, or basically competitive groups, people that have filed for the same frequency that you have filed for, and that's simply abbreviated MX. The FCC eventually releases lists of who applied and bunches these applications together in the MX groups. And once you have the names of the people of the groups that also have filed in your MX group, you're going to have to figure out how to either negotiate with them, or have your engineer look at your application and see if there's any type of technical amendment that you can file. You might want to approach some of the other groups and see if they're actually still interested in pursuing the LPFM application. Maybe you want to, at certain times, the FCC will allow you to reimburse these applications these applicants to dismiss their applications, or you can combine your points with them and form another group to sort of, and the FCC will grant the application to whoever pulls together the most amount of points in your groups.
About two more minutes.
Okay. And that's basically you're trying to settle with the other groups. And if you don't settle with the other groups, the FCC has what they call a point hearing, where they decide for you who gets the frequency. They'll scrutinize the applications. They could force you into even, say, a seven-way share time or something like that. So it's better to try to work these issues out with the groups yourself, because that's what the FCC wants you to do. You can also file what's called petitions to deny against the other groups. If 30 days of them releasing that point declaration of who won the construction permit, and then finally after that, sometimes they'll grant the final construction permit to the bunch of groups or single applicant.
Okay, sounds good.
Thank you, Todd. So before we turn to the local angle, I just wanted to put out a couple of questions that I'm hoping when we do the Q&A that some of you will address and the panel will address, and we can kind of brainstorm together about, sort of on the larger angle of above and beyond the particular questions of how to fill out the application for your frequency. One of them, which is I think a big challenge that we face, is how to identify and find and motivate a local, trustworthy, reliable, accessible, accountable entity in each and every signal area across the country where we have an available license. Because otherwise we are taking that license and we are basically throwing it out with the bathwater, turning it into a chain outlet for, shall we say, redundant programming, rather than something unique and local and meaningful to the particular place where it's centered. So I would really love to hear your ideas about how we go ahead and do that, not only here in Northern California, which is of course our regional responsibility, but really all across the country. Some of you are here because you've heard about this opportunity, so I'm interested in your ideas about how to sort of evangelize that this opportunity is out there. And also to encourage people to work together for an available frequency rather than knock each other out. The second question is really one about the rules and whether the rules will be fair and whether the rules to come will be crafted in such a way that they'll make it more possible rather than less possible for these frequencies to meet their full potential. And I know that FCC rulemaking and notifications of proposed rulemaking and filing comments puts everybody to sleep. I understand that because I ask people to file comments all of the time and they look at me and say, I don't think so. So any sort of, you know, feedback or communication that you have about how we work together to make sure that these rules are good rules, not bad rules, is something that I really like to hear from everybody from. And with that, we're going to turn to Susan Gallimore, who is a producer with Raising Sand Radio, and also a member of the Alameda Public Affairs Forum, which is one group or offshoot of that is looking at possibly filing an LPFM application in the upcoming window. So she's going to talk a little bit about why they're doing that, how they're doing that, how it is going, and share some experiences back and forth.
Well, first I want to say thank you for arranging this, Tracy. Tracy's part of our group in Alameda, in a way, and this is something that we really appreciate, to both to meet everybody in this area and also to talk a little bit about what we're learning. So thank you for all coming. So I'm going to talk a little bit about how I got into radio and then describe our town, and then I'm going to talk a little more about the issues that we're facing. So I grew up in a country where we didn't have television, and radio was a big part of my life, lying in bed at night with the radio on, listening to radio plays or kids' stories or whatever. But I never thought that I would do radio myself. It seemed something that was kind of out there. But I've been working in the internet field for the last 15 years, and multimedia is just part of that. And several years ago, I was invited to be part of a program at Stanford on their radio show. And so I got really intrigued. I got air clear there. And it just was completely automatic for me to think about using the computer, even though we were broadcasting around the South Bay, to use the computer to start uploading my shows. And I called it Raising Sand Radio. And after about 4 years, I was putting out a show every week. And after about 4 years, driving down to Stanford got a little much, and I was out of the country and so forth. So I decided to not do broadcasting from the station, but just to continue with the internet. And so it was a big deal because every week I was putting out a show, and I really didn't have that much experience in the radio side of it. So I was both learning and uploading these shows and doing very politically progressive shows. And then I began to, so this was like my issues, the topics that I was dealing with were not specifically around our town. Now let me talk a little bit about what that town is. It's an island town, and it's just off Oakland. If you go across the Bay Bridge, you'll see us kind of where the harbor is. And so it's a long, skinny town, and it used to have a military base there. So a lot of the people that lived there were affiliated with the military base. This means fairly conservative. And I started thinking about, I've been involved in city issues, partly working with the contamination on the base, and thinking about, you know, how do you really get the word out about what really is going on? Because the way they're cleaning up the base does not bode well for people that are going to be living on that base in the future, but the people of Alameda don't seem to know. We also had a lot of other issues, social and city-related issues. And so I suggested to someone in our city who's quite active that we create a media center. And what I meant by that was something that would, you know, begin to educate people along the more progressive lines of what we could be doing in our town. And at the same time, someone else talked to that same person who's a lawyer and has been working with the radio groups for a very long time. And he was thinking the same thing. So he was thinking radio, I was thinking media center, and we basically kind of came together on this. And since then, a few more people have joined us. Barry is one of those people. And another fellow who does radio, it's very sort of avant-garde music, and he streams it through a station in the Netherlands. So we each have a little piece of this giant puzzle that we're trying to put together. And at the same time, we're dealing with all of the technical stuff that we've heard here. Where we are right now, we've been working on this for about 6 months, I think, something like that. And so as part of our desire, I actually do have a nonprofit, but we are not going to be using my nonprofit to promote this. It looks like everything's kind of up in the air. But we don't want to associate too strongly with my radio station because the issues are very progressive and they're also very international. And we don't want to scare the people in our town that are quite conservative. So we're kind of working this sort of base. We do have a community college in our town which doesn't do radio yet, but we're approaching them to say, would you like to present classes or workshops on radio? This is what we can do. This is, we can talk about how to do the technical side of it, the computer side of it, the announcing anchor side of it. So I think we have some potential there. We also have some progressive churches. We have there's a lot of potential, but we're not quite sure how to just start going for it right now. Because as we've heard, you can apply for this, you can apply, and it's going to still take a couple of years. So those of us who have experience on the internet side are promoting that. Let's start doing that. Let's get people used to it. It'll also help us when we get to fundraising, you know, those kinds of issues. Now, again, our little island is a long, skinny island, so we would require quite specific engineering to get to meet the requirements without bleeding over into Oakland. Or we would have to collaborate with people in Oakland. So there's a lot of issues that I really can't speak to because that's not my expertise. But it's fun, and it's a challenge, and it's quite possible that we can do this because there was a station that started there. It was called KJazz, and KJazz had a studio right near my house in my town, but it broadcast off Russian Hill here in San Francisco, and apparently it was a very well-known station. It subsequently closed down. I think it was sold, and then it moved somewhere else, and now it's somewhere in Texas or something. But those are the issues that we're dealing with in our town, this sort of social, political side on the one hand, and then the sort of technical, how do we go about this? How do we just do the steps to get this to happen? So I would be more than happy to answer questions about that side of it, and hopefully we can encourage you. I'd also like to encourage people that are in the audience that have radio stations locally to talk to me, because I'm sure that we can learn from one another, you know, how you do things, how we do things, how I've done things, how I've broadcast my shows when I've been in other countries, South Africa, for example. It's very difficult, but you can do it. And so there's a lot of techniques that I think we can share if, you know, if we're working together in different radio stations in the Bay Area. So I'd be happy to meet you and to talk about that.
Okay, thanks, Susan. Okay, so I think at this point we want to leave a little bit of room for people to speak to each other. As Susan said, there are experiences to be shared, and some of you may be in the position of possibly collaborating on a proposal at some point in the future. But two pieces of logistical things. We passed around a sign-on sheet. If you did not sign it, we'd like to really encourage you to sign it. Number one, we want to be able to put you in touch with each other when necessary. And two, there are a lot of resources and informational things that we can make available. So please do sign the sign-in sheet.
Did anyone not get it?
I'm saying this because it doesn't look like there are as many names on it as
there are. Oh, no, there's...
Okay. Fair enough, then. And I think what we'll do with the next 30 minutes or so is answer your specific questions or comments about what you've heard or what you haven't heard and would like to hear.
Gavin is going to run around with the mic.
Just say your name and you know, maybe if you're with a group, station or organization, let us know.
Did you have it?
I just wanted to ask about, I guess, a technological question with, you know, I hear about digital radio. I haven't explored it myself, but, you know, are these frequencies going to become relevant in the future? How does digital radio play into what's going on? Thank you.
That's a really good question. For one thing, the UK is looking at turning off their analog radio, but we haven't heard that yet in the States.
Anybody?
Yes, we have.
On the digital question?
Digital radio hasn't had that good of market penetration. In fact, I think its popularity has even started to decrease among consumers. They've been trying to push it for the last few years, and it just hasn't caught on. It's an expensive, proprietary technological innovation, as they say, but they really messed up in the type of digital radio that they chose to be the next radio. And it's expensive for broadcasters. Not that many people are listening to it. It's hard to find a receiver, a consumer receiver, anybody who knows about it, if you go to buy one. So it just really hasn't caught on, and I don't. It might even possibly decrease in popularity over then.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
that is that, in case people aren't clear on this, unlike digital television, it's not there's not a mandatory turnover time like Gavin mentioned in the UK. So there's not a point at which we're all going to have to turn off our old radios and go to digital. That's not a surprise.
That's Brandy Doyle. She's our policy director at Prometheus Radio Project, and she deals with the FCC. So if y'all have any policy questions or want to know about filing comments and the rulemaking, she's the girl to talk to. So thanks for coming, Brandy. I just wanted to add that we get a lot of questions about satellite radio and HD radio and streaming online and, you know, all these new technologies. And, you know, why should we bother with broadcasting and radio still? And the simple answer to that is that there's still a huge digital divide in this country. There's a lot of people that don't have access to internet, a lot of communities in the Midwest, especially, that don't have broadband access. And, you know, there's a lot of people that are still low literacy, so they're not able to, even if they have access, go online and read and understand the software that you need to use. And so for all those reasons, you know, traditional radio is still really relevant and important because it's still free to consume and easy to produce and widely accessible. Do you know anyone who has an HD radio receiver? I don't know. There's plenty of people that have satellite radio. There's one guy. There's plenty of people, you know, that use satellite radio, but it's very expensive to install, you know, the XM and satellite radio, or Sirius radio. And so I think it's going to be a while before, you know, everyone has access to those technologies. And I think that's why this kind of radio is still really important, especially when you're trying to reach those communities that are most marginalized.
One other thing, the technology doesn't work too well either.
Yeah.
Oh, details.
Next question.
Is the 10 watt cheaper to get started? Is if you had a 10 watt station, like if I'm in Fruitvale, by the way, and which is right near Alameda, and if I started something in the nonprofit, which is supposed to give voice to the cultures that have been creating and transforming California, and we have a historical park there. If I set up a radio station there with a 10 watt, would it bump into yours and Alameda, or are the 10 watts somehow on a separate plane than the bigger ones?
Well, right now there's no LP10 stations because there's no filing window for them. But I wouldn't look at that as the cost of the transmitter, because you're still going to need to put together a studio, which is going to be the same amount. So you're just looking at the actual cost difference of the transmitter itself. So it's not going to be that much of a substantial of a savings.
Even if we have a building already?
I would just apply for whatever's available, and then from there figure it out after you apply.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, just to kibitz, that's partially a contouring question, and you may have some flexibility in terms of where your transmitter is that may impact how far your signal would go and whether it would interfere, for example, with an Alameda-based signal, which would hopefully be contoured in a very horizontal way, because that's the way Alameda goes.
And you're not responsible to program 24/7, or you are, once you have a frequency.
I believe you are responsible for programming 24/7. Is that correct?
No, there's some.
Todd?
Traditionally, stations have been able to sign off, but since everybody has a computer nowadays, people just go to automation. So it's just easy to flick a switch.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And we do a lot of work in Fruitvale, so I'd like to connect with you afterwards.
Yeah, you should join our little group.
I would like to.
That'd be great.
All right. Hi, again, I'm Jim with Austin Airways in Austin, North Texas. We're here at the NFCB conference. I want to speak on behalf of our cohort and ally, Stephen Dunifer of Free Radio Berkeley, well known here in the area.
Stephen and his group are one of the main providers of what we call boxes, the transmitters used largely by free and unlicensed stations. Most of the equipment you would want to set up for an LPFM is fairly easily applied. I've gotten old CD players, laptops, microphones, and the like. The key thing is the transmitter. If you're interested in this issue, you know, go to Free Radio Berkeley. Now, their transmitters are not currently what's known as type accepted. A professional engineer here might help me out. They have to meet industry standards, having been inspected, right? Type accepted. Mm-hmm. And they're not currently, but they're working on it. Them and another free radio advocate in Oakland, Armstrong Radio. Again, Armstrong Radio and Free Radio Berkeley are both working to get a new LPFM transmitter design type accepted. It means it has to be taken to a certified laboratory, which has various standards to be approved, which is very expensive. Prohibitively expensive right now. But again, the main piece of equipment that would maybe most difficult to acquire, that is you can't get a donation of it, like a couple laptops, will be the transmitter. Can I expand on that?
Yeah.
Sure.
I have an add-on comment.
Okay.
I can just yell, Stephen Jennifer, who is the father of pirate radio, will be offering radio camps in the Bay Area. They will, I think they're in June, July, and there are also some in August, September. It's approximately a 3 to 4 day commitment, everything you need to know to build your own radio station. We do have on our website the dates and times, and people should seriously consider going to radio camp. You'll learn a lot.
Yeah, I'm Michael Brown. I have a consulting firm, do FCC applications all over the country, including low power FM. And there's actually at least 3 frequencies available in the Bay Area. In fact, I did some studies this morning for at least 10 waters. And depending on how the rules shake out, there could be more. Actually, we're pretty lucky in that regard. We don't know. I think you talked about before I got in about we're not really sure what the rules are exactly going to look like. So it's kind of a moving target. We have to make some assumptions. But the good news is one way or the other, there are some frequencies in the Bay Area. It could be 3 or more. At this point, with the worst case scenario, they would all have to be 10 watt stations. But there's a lot of scenarios that could pan out in the next 6 months that would allow them to be the 100 watts. As far as the transmitters, there's a number of manufacturers that make transmitters that are suitable for the 10 or 100 watt LPFMs that are somewhere in the range of $2,500 to $4,000. They're ready to go and they're approved now. The hope is, of course, that we can get that cost down with these additional supplies, but in that range that are available now and being used. If anybody has any specific technical questions, I'm here also.
Great, thanks.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you 2 questions. The first one was kind of an offhand comment, and that was that if your application fails, you're never going to be able to apply again. I wasn't sure if I heard that right. Is that specific to that frequency, or your organization can never file for another again?
No.
Okay, good. Then the second thing was a little larger, and
the blacklist.
It had to do with the multitude of frequencies that were being filed by churches or, you know, neocon organizations and whatnot. Are every one of those frequencies being filed by a surrogate group, so like some thumper church files for it, but they're always going to be accepting the feed from?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. We might get a word.
I got to jump in on
more than a
really
one-word answer.
Make sure I'm near the camera. There are some really good religious radio stations who do local community service. Not every religious radio station is part of a massive network, but the vast majority on the FM airwaves in the U.S. are part of.
Can you name one so we can go look at it, see if we agree?
Good Religious Radio.
What's that?
The 103, what's the guys?
The Unitarian Church.
Yeah, the nice
Unitarian churches have quite a few.
Unitarian churches, and then we were on a panel together in Boston with the guy.
Oh, Paul Billings,
Paul,
103
up,
The Beat.
Look up 103 The Beat, Paul Billings. He's in the Midwest, and he does really great youth programs and like that. They're faith-based, but they're also doing real community service. And when he didn't know about the big consolidated groups, and we heard about that these big churches were taking up all these hundreds and hundreds of channels, he was outraged.
Okay, so his name is Paul?
Paul Billings. That's just a good example.
Oh, I think there's also a local, I remember after the Oscar Grant verdict, there was a religious station from the Bay Area that was actually out kind of quelling protesters and riots.
Well, that was, that, they were working for City Hall, the quellers.
Yeah, it was awesome.
The quellers.
They were out, not working for the people.
They were out of their station, kind of on the street.
Who else has a question?
Quellers.
Well, yeah, hi. I just want to follow up what you raised. My main interest in radio isn't technical. I grew up in the shitty age of radio in the 60s where, you know, you'd hear a rock song you liked and the DJ would go on 30 seconds into the song. So I was grew up in West Virginia, so I was a long way from any Pacifica affiliate. So my question is, given the track record of the FCC, now, the FCC, ideologically, aren't right-wingers for the most part, but given a choice between an application, a competition, let's say, between some Christian fundamentalist nonprofit, quote-unquote, and some progressive nonprofit, I think they would probably be more likely to give it to the Christian fundamentalist group. So I wonder if anybody had any thoughts about that, because it seems to me that even if progressive groups try to be unoffensive and try to couch their application and we just want to do community service, it seems like there will be a lot of de facto political competition for these licenses. So anybody have any thoughts about that? That's what I'm going to raise.
Yeah, my comment is short. I'll let Brandy elaborate more on that. But the FCC doesn't currently distinguish among programming or, you know, the kind of nonprofit you are.
Not officially, but unofficially.
No, it really doesn't. It's a lot depends on the engineering of the application. Why, as you know, Todd mentioned, it's so important that you fill it out correctly and you don't have any mistakes. You have to meet all the requirements. The point system looks at a lot of different elements in addition to having nonprofit status for more than 2 years. That's why some of these churches are successful, because you know, they've been around, almost all of them, for more than 2 years. Unfortunately, they don't really look and see, you know, what kind of organization is. And, you know, aside from political affiliations, I think one thing Prometheus encounters a lot is looking at groups who actually have the capacity to run a station effectively. You know, if you have, you know, reach to the community, engagement, if you have the ability to recruit and sustain volunteers, if you're able to fundraise effectively, those are all more important factors, in our opinion, in being able to actually get the license and hold it. The FCC doesn't look at, you know, whether or not you're some crazy dysfunctional nonprofit or if you're a really awesome progressive group that has their stuff together. No, they don't delineate. I don't think of those things.
I think the best way to think of the FCC is as a vast bureaucracy obsessed with stupid, pointless details,
yes,
and basically presenting with a values neutral. They're far more concerned with whether you filled out the right boxes than really what you're planning to program at all. And that's sad, but I think that's really very much the truth. So I think what people are trying to tell you is to use that to your advantage. The reason why community organizations often lose out on the MXs to these large chains is that large, what we're calling bad religious broadcasters do it on an ongoing basis in a syndicated way over and over again, so they get all the details right. And of course, our funky little community organizations struggle to meet that level of syndication and accuracy and detailness and comprehensiveness. And that's why groups like Prometheus and Common Frequency that can help you ape the religious right with your application, because they do them over and over and over again, are really priceless resources that you should take advantage of.
I have to jump in. One other quick response. In the 1990s, Congress passed the Telecommunications Act, and that allowed the big ownership to get even bigger, allowed the consolidation that we've seen. And then one of the big effects of that has been a huge cuts to the workforce. So in broadcast. So the one other thing is, I think that some of that feeling you have about, I just get the sense that they're out there trying to stifle our free speech and or picking winners. Keep in mind, Congress does that. So if you want to get involved in a policy discussion, Congress is one of the places to take it, because we wouldn't have the consolidation we have without that.
No,
Okay, more questions?
Hi, I'm Kay. I've been around for a whole bunch since I see Dan Gunning, but I used to be at KJC with, and I did some free Radio Berkeley, but the sexism was just scathing, as well as the racism. So he was possibly considered the father of pirate radio because people of color that were doing real things got busted. They let him go because he was doing their work a lot. So it's nice the equipment got out, but there were stories on that too. I'm a little concerned not to see Pirate Cat and FCC Free and Valencia Radio here. Are some of them here?
Pirate Cat was here.
Oh, okay. Is that you, Mickey? No.
No.
Okay. Okay, Mickey's gone, but yeah, it's fine. Okay. Because it's something that's there, and being able to have air time, I didn't live in that neighborhood for Pirate Cats. I couldn't get it. But I can't afford a $500 device to be able to walk around and carry a radio like my little on-air radio. It's this big. It's three buttons. I can listen to stuff when I'm out going out and around. If something comes on the internet, I have to stay home. So it creates a digital divide. What was I going to say? Yeah, one other thing. I don't know, it probably is irrelevant, but the FTC now has somebody pretty good running the show if we can get them to crosstalk a little bit. There's the guy that was... Does anybody here know about EFF, Electronic Frontier
yes.
Foundation? Because you probably should also talk to them in terms of lawyers that are ready for them to do stupid things to kick you out. where was I? Yeah, but one of the guys who had been in one of their cases that they had chosen and created the case is now running, I believe, the FTC. And so there's somebody that understands the questions and is cool. And the last thing was, there was a little pirate radio station off, it was on the Oakland side, but it broadcast to Alameda back. I don't remember what year that was. It was when the Alameda computer recycling place, or the big computer recycling place was right mm-hmm. over. They had a couple of old guys that had been doing it for years and a huge record collection. It was quite established. Mm-hmm. So I guess they went down when it moved. I haven't heard from them since. So I'm looking forward to talking to people afterwards.
Hi, I'm Betty McArdle with Community Media Assistance Project. And what you're hearing today is a lot of great information, but also, well, we don't quite know yet. And we're not going to know for a little while. And it may be. But I want to encourage all of you to do a lot of the work now. Because if you wait until the FCC announces the new rules and announces when the window's going to be, we'll only have about 3 to 6 months to get the work done. So get out there, get your groups organized, look at the application, find out what it is you're going to have in the way of board of directors within so many miles of your studio location. Fundraise and then fundraise and then fundraise. But don't wait until the last minute. I have gone through such agony with this engineer person here, with the clients waiting until the last minute, and then we're up, 3 days in a row getting them filed at the last minute. So just take a little piece of advice and get started now.
I have a comment and a question. I think it's great you're trying to start something in Alameda, and it's an interesting coincidence that Harold Camping and the whole board
yes.
of directors of Family Radio, they all live in Alameda. I was
yeah.
checking out information in the FCC database, so...
Yeah,
it's
true.
It's nice to provide that balance. And then a question about pirate broadcasters, since there are a lot of people in the Bay Area who've been at pirate stations. How does that affect the LPFM application process for them? Is there anything that they're shut out of? What are the rules around that?
I can answer, but someone else sure can.
Yeah, you can. Go for it.
Okay. Glad to be here in Pirate Central. we live longing from Texas. if you are formally served in writing and identified as an individual with your name on paper served by the federal officer of the Federal Communications Commission, you are likely ineligible to apply for an LPFM. Am I correct?
Actually, do you have to be fined?
No, not fined necessarily, but you have to be served.
Just served with a notice of apparent
liability.
Okay.
As most of the pirates in the Bay Area who've been visited, right? Congratulations, you've stuck up for the First Amendment. Typically what happens, and certainly what happens in Austin, Texas, and if you'd like to see a video I shot of Chaos, KAOS Radio, a free station in Austin, Texas, which was visited by Federal Agent Stephen P. Lee, I videotaped that. It's available at Chaos Radio Austin. It's not a very dramatic thing. It's just kind of a frumpy bureaucrat. You can lie and say you don't have your ID on you, and you can give a bogus name, which is part of the funniest part of the video. But there are all these extra provisions in LPFM. I sort of equate it to the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Act, where the actual law that comes out is kind of a little weird because they fought and overcame, and this is what came out. And we had enormous opposition from highly powerful, you know, the NAB and unfortunately NPR fought this thing tooth and nail for 10 years. So if you operate a free station, my advice as an individual is do not tell them your real name, do not be a threat, take the station off the air. And our rule of thumb in Austin, the two rules are one, we call potting shed radio. We advise you not to operate a station in someone's home. You're bound to have something that's not 100% legal or your roommate or a friend of your roommate. And two, our other rule of thumb is if you get popped at a location, that's it for that location. Move on and have somebody else be your forward person. And I'd be glad to answer afterwards any other questions.
It is really a video worth watching. Chaos Radio Austin. Sorry. More questions back here?
Yeah. Regarding the earlier question about the massive takeover of these micropower stations, has anybody been tracking the actual consolidation? Are they essentially frauding the FCC by claiming that they're low power when in fact they're a massive chain, always running Focus on the Family, always running the neocon programming? Basically, I listen to a lot of these stations streaming, and they're always running the same format, the same lineup, and so is there some sort of way of determining whether they're actually frauding the low power status as providing community service, or are they in fact just a front group for the neocons?
Okay, Vanessa.
Yeah, I was gonna
that one to that one.
Well, there's over 500 of these kinds of stations, so it's really hard to listen to all of them and sift through all their programming. It's really, really hard. The other thing is that there's only a minimum requirement to broadcast local programming. What is it, Brandy? Is it like 8 hours a week or something like that? There's no requirement. Okay.
If you make a commitment, you've got a preference point in the point system. And where the fraud was is some of these stations
did not
said they were going to broadcast localism and they really didn't.
Right.
Just turned on the satellite.
So if you've committed to doing that in your application, you got the extra point for that. That's where the commitment lies. But if you were a singleton, for example, and you didn't rely on those points, then you don't have to do that. What's the other thing? So all of these licenses, they're not permanent. They're not forever. They come up on renewals. And just like any broadcaster, the public has the opportunity to issue comments or communicate with the FCC that the broadcaster is not using the license for the public interest. Some people now are advocating for those family radio station licenses to be revoked or, for their renewal to be in question based on the you know, depending on what your beliefs are, fraudulent content that was broadcast on the airwaves. There's lots of rules we know that the FCC has that you must comply with. For example, there's indecency rules. You can't broadcast hate speech. There's rules around underwriting. You can't broadcast advertising. So if the station breaks any of those rules consistently, then the public has a pretty compelling argument to present to the FCC to you know, take the license away from the holder. So unfortunately, that's kind of like the best way you can hold those stations accountable, but it's really up to the folks in the community to, you know, pay attention to what's being broadcast and to decide whether or not they want to argue for the license to be taken away.
I think an important question.
Are there materials available for Spanish speakers who are interested in pursuing LPFM? It seems like that could be one of the really great ways that we can have more representation of this hugely growing community in the U.S. What's kind of Prometheus's trajectory? What's your plan as far as, you know, getting Spanish speakers to apply?
So we have a number of materials being translated right now into Espanol. We're going to be putting them on our website shortly so that communities who would like to apply for low power FM stations can understand all this material. We also have a series of webinars that we've been doing with the same sort of information. We've been doing all across the country. We did 4 last month. We have another couple coming up this summer, one at the end of the month. Those dates will be posted on our website. And we will be translating one of them into Spanish so that people can download it and listen to it in Spanish or English.
You want to give kind of how Radio Summer in San Francisco fits into the Radio Summer campaign?
Sure. So we're really excited to launch Radio Summer, our first event here in the Bay Area. So thank you all for coming and participating. Radio Summer is a campaign to do outreach all across the U.S., let people know that this opportunity to apply for a low-power FM radio station exists, and to get communities talking about making media in their city or town. We are organizing events all over the country, and we are encouraging nonprofits and groups like Susan's to hold these meetings in their community, media makers, so public access TV stations and other existing radio stations. We want people to organize and have a conversation about this opportunity to figure out who's interested, what resources are available, who wants to collaborate, and then also have a wider discussion about what the landscape of media is like in their community. So asking questions like, what's missing, what stories aren't being covered, who's not being represented, how can we use our station as a tool for social justice and change. And so if you'd like more information about this campaign and you want to hold an event in your community, I see some of you came from other towns, that's great. You can go to radiosummer.org, and we have a bunch of toolkits on there. So there's a bunch of handouts that give you information about how to start a station and also tools to organize in your community, how to do outreach, sample meeting agendas, so it gives you questions and things to talk about with your group. And then also we're trying to connect organizations and people who have resources like free meeting space with people who actually want to hold meetings. So for example, we have this great space that we're using. And we're doing that throughout now to September. So we encourage you, if you would like, to have more than one conversation, and that way you keep the enthusiasm going and the momentum. So when the rule making comes, you will already have a group in place that's sort of on board with your project. To that end, I noticed a lot of you are formerly or still from radio stations. And so that means you have some interest in writing or playing music and telling stories. And I think that, you know, while you're waiting to get your license and get your station on the air, there's no reason why you can't continue to make media. There's lots of great independent community media outlets here in the Bay Area. So I would encourage you to, you know, write stories about LPFM, write stories about the need for more local media. connect with the other people around you to see if you can share skills. So while you're waiting for the license, it could be a couple years, but you can start streaming online, you can blog, you can make videos, you can have a show on your public access TV station, you can maybe collaborate with independent producers and make a documentary, you can make art, make something. That's like the biggest message that we have, that you know, we can't afford to wait several years to start telling these stories and putting out these messages to the public. Find other ways to do it while you wait for the license.
Okay, so a couple of things. We advertised this event from 3:30 to 5:30, and then we found out they start locking the bottom of the library exactly at 5:30, so we're gonna leave some open space here, but if you remain in this location after 5:30, you may not get out. We're not guaranteeing. So it goes on Saturday. People want to get home. Thank you so much for coming. I just want to say briefly that we have regional resources here. This is the beginning of a conversation, not the ending of a conversation, in answer to the sort of Christian right-wing fraud question. I think when we set up scenarios where there are singleton applications for available licenses and they're only from these folks, that we're sort of getting what we deserve. It's on us to do better than that. And that's the purpose of this meeting. And I'm hoping that all of you will be evangelists and take this information to 50 other people in your neighborhood and your community and let them know, and let them know that it's possible and they can do it and it's not that hard. And with that, thank you so much for coming. We will be in touch, and I think we have a last word here. Yes, sir.
Hi, I'm Patrick Sims. I'm with Mutiny Radio, formerly Pirate Cat Radio.
Yay!
And we're trying to be more closely tied to our community. And with that, we're also looking for content and people who are interested taking part. We're online at PCR Collective right now. Come see me, myself, Catherine, Raymond, Seth, whoever, and we'd love to talk to you.
Thank you. One more announcement. The good folks at the San Francisco Bay Area Independent Media Center have recorded this session, and hopefully they will be posting online at their website, www.indiebay.org. So if you'd like to share this with friends, look out for this audio piece on their website. It's also being filmed by
Media Alliance.
By Media Alliance.
We'll make it available as well.
So the video will be online as well. Please pass this around. We know that you have folks all around the country that you know that might be interested. Share the link with them and post stuff on your social networks as well.
Thank you.